Good afternoon. It's just gone 1 o'clock on a Tuesday afternoon. I'm Silly Sherilambus, your host for the Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com. I'm joined in studio by the evergreen Brooks Spector. Welcome, Brooks. Good to see you. It's been a while since we've had you. Our favorite Australian reporter at the Daily Maverick, Greg Nicholson.
Thanks for having me.
And Andrea Teagle, the person responsible for Fact of the Day and a whole bunch of other things on First Thing, our daily newsletter that goes out to the Daily Maverick subscriber base as well as the Cliff Central subscribers as well. So we're going to kick off with our fact of the day, and I think Andrea, since you're the expert, this is your domain. We're going to hand over to you for your fun fact of the day.
Okay, great. Well, the fact of today is about the Cape ground squirrel. They have very impressive genitalia, which are actually 40% the length of their bodies. They're so big, in fact, that they can and frequently do perform oral masturbation.
On themselves,
yeah.
I believe the term's autofillate.
Well, yeah, I kind of wondered if everyone would know what that means. So, but there was a researcher in Namibia who spent quite a disturbing amount of time watching these squirrels masturbate. And they used, there's actually a very funny description of this, so I actually thought I would just read it.
Who funded this research?
I didn't read the study, but it's in a very reputable scientific blog, so I think it's
somebody paid for this.
But anyway, so she describes it like this: an oral masturbation was recorded when a male sat with head lowered and an erect penis in his mouth, being stimulated with both mouth and forepaws, while the lower torso moved forward and backwards in thrusting motions. Finally, culminated in an apparent ejaculation, after which the male appeared to consume the ejaculate.
Oh.
Yeah, and she went on to...
That was a surprise ending.
I know. Well, she went on to...
Welcome to the over 18 show.
Yeah. Well, anyway, but this is important because the theory behind it is that they don't just do this for pleasure, but it's a type of self-cleansing to reduce the chance that they get sexually transmitted infections, because apparently with squirrels this actually is effective, obviously. That, with how, people, not so much.
How does that work? Through that process, how do you avoid STIs?
You know, they don't really give a whole lot of detail here, but apparently the mouth cleans the outside, and then you know, they get rid of all the stuff inside, and it's apparently helpful.
So it probably also reduces the incentive to go and, you know, fiddle in somewhere that's not as clean anymore. But I feel like after that, Andrea, I should tell you to just talk into the microphone a little bit more. okay, so that's the fun fact of the day. I remember reading somewhere that if we converted those dimensions of the Cape ground squirrel into a human being, that it, you know, the male would have a 30-centimeter long scrotum. That would be kind of uncomfortable. And
yeah, it's a lot to carry around.
I feel like we should just stop the show right now. Where can we go to from here?
I think you've effectively covered the universe here.
Yeah, okay. I think speaking of scrotums, Greg, you did a piece on Gwedeman Teshe coming out and saying, when people are abnormal, rules do not apply. We're seeing this weird sentiment coming out from the ANC, or the ruling party at the moment, sort of battening down the hatches, going a little bit ballistic. I mean, is there another word for what's going on in this sort of the communication that's coming out of the ANC at the moment?
I think it's, in a way, it's to be expected. I don't know how to sum it up in one word, but they're under a lot of pressure, and the ANC is getting sort of put through what they often put other parties through, sort of with their bullying tactics in parliament and their domineering sort of behavior. So what's been going on is, obviously, as we all know, the EFF have been using sort of key moments when President Zuma and Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa appear in parliament. The EFF use those moments specifically to make protests and demonstrations and get the headlines of the newspapers. So we've seen the pay back the money chant. We saw last week Floyd Chivambur, the EFF commissar, give stick up his middle finger to Deputy President Ramaphosa and the EFF members saying, you've got blood on your hands, you killed workers in Marikana. And as the media goes, you know, Parliament generally is a pretty boring affair. So this sort of stuff happens, and it gets the newspapers, gets the attention. And it's driving the ANC nuts. It's absolutely driving them crazy. They can't sort of put up with it, and especially because it's their own, the byproducts of their own growth and dominance, and that actually helped get Zuma to power in 2009. That's doing this. It's just driving them so mad. And so, what it looks like they're sort of finally starting to do is, they're so frustrated, that they're even sort of saying that they want two things to happen right now. First of all, they want Parliament to sort of tighten up the rules or really enforce the rules stringently and institute harsh penalties for those who do not meet the rules. But it's not easy to do that. We've already seen with the payback the money chant where EFF refused to leave the National Assembly. It's taken until now for the sort of disciplinary procedures to begin.
And the ANC, and the ruling party themselves are flouting some of the rules of Parliament, you know, not answering questions, not tending to the questions. And, you know, so it's quite difficult to come down hard on what they want is opposition. They want to come down hard on opposition in Parliament.
That's right. I think the ANC is sort of getting around things a little bit easier than the EFF is. The EFF has to make these big grand gestures. But sometimes the president, deputy president, and others in parliament are getting away with not answering questions specifically as to the question. And some of the criticism is that's because of the speaker Bleka Mbete, who's the national chairperson of the ANC. People are saying that she's giving them an easy ride. But that's sort of open for debate. But so the ANC first of all wants parliament to enforce the rules better, but that's not easy to do. So now it's almost like the ANC is sort of giving up on Parliament, or at least these little opportunities, and saying, okay, now how can we reach the people better? Because the EFF is getting all the headlines. And so what the ANC sort of wants to do now is they've thought that Parliament is a bit of a lost game, especially on these big occasions, the times when the President and the Deputy President's there. So now what they actually want to do is the ANC want to send Zuma and other top leaders out to the community much more, which actually looks sort of like an election campaign strategy, but we're still about, a bit under 2 years away from the next election. So what we could actually see is the ANC on the ground a lot more and engaging with citizens a lot more than we would get in the normal off-election period.
Brooks, does this feel like a knee-jerk reaction, panic reaction to what's going on at the moment? I mean, Ranjini Munsami wrote in her piece yesterday saying this is officially the point where the ANC loses the plot of how a democratic state should be run. Do you agree with her?
Let me put it this way. Picture a very large...
We're not going back to the Cape Squirrel, are we?
No. Very large gorilla with extremely sensitive skin and a very angry swarm of mosquitoes. The mosquitoes are not going to kill the gorilla. The mosquitoes are not, in fact, going to do much damage to it, but they sure irritate it like crazy. And the problem for the governing party, I've stopped calling them the ruling party, they're the governing party. The problem for them is they know that without any effort at all, they can pass any piece of legislation which enters the parliament because they have an absolute majority plus. They can manage the process of all the hearings and the portfolio committees, and they can manage the time clock for debate. What they can't do anymore is manage the content of the debate that precedes any vote. So they win on every issue, but lose on the texture of the legitimacy of the way the issues are discussed. And of course, the media is a willing co-conspirator in this, because the media loves the controversy, it loves the color and the discomfort, it loves the argument. I mean, it's made parliamentary television something worth watching, at least on certain days. It's much more interesting than watching reruns of old soap operas. The problem is there's no way around it. There's no way around this unpleasant process for the ANC other than to put up with it and come up with ways to make it increasingly uncomfortable for the economic freedom fighters or even the DA if they should rise up from their slumber. And as long as this happens, you're going to have this unseemly spectacle over almost every single issue. I mean, you can rub your hands with glee as you wait for the discussion about the newest ultra big deal, the nuclear power deal, which depending on who you read or listen to weighs in at somewhere between a couple hundred billion rand and a trillion or more. I mean, your great-grandchildren may be paying for some of this by the time they finish it. But there must be debate about it because it must become a budgetary issue. There must be discussion about the propriety of using this bidder, and since there was only one bidder, they must have a discussion about whether or not there are alternative energy sources. It's going to get bogged down in all kinds of arcana over the science of it. It's also going to get bogged down in the budgetary details. But what's going to become important is the spectacle of the ANC having to defend an issue that most of the people in the party clearly had no idea was coming their way.
Greg, do you agree with the sentiment that they've given up the ghost in making those, enforcing those changes through Parliament, in enacting those changes, or getting, you know, going the route of harsher penalties?
No, I certainly don't, because the ANC would like to see that happen, but they just know that it's a long process and it's sort of difficult to mete out, and you can't. It's difficult to bring those changes about at the time when these protests happen. They sort of play out later on. You know, it's sort of like in the media. You know, when someone publishes a headline that might be wrong front page, and then you have to go to the ombudsman, and then later on there's going to be a little page three one paragraph.
Page 23, more like it. Yeah.
That's right, with an apology there. It's sort of the same thing in Parliament. It does take a while for these things to pan out, and for responsibility to be sort of held and meted out. So I'm sure the ANC still want that to happen, because they need that to happen at least over a longer sort of period. But in these sessions of when the House is sitting, all that can really happen is for the National Assembly or Blek Mbete, the Speaker, to either send out whoever is at fault, if someone won't withdraw their comments, perhaps, or in the case in August when we saw the EFF refuse to leave during their payback the money protest, then the National Assembly had to be put off together. So the key thing is, I think they still want to try and tighten up Parliament, the ANC I'm talking about, mm-hmm. but at the same time they're looking at other avenues now as well to see what they can do to communicate with the people.
Well, they can't very well ignore the Parliament entirely, mm-hmm. because there are certain processes that have to be followed to pass laws and budgets and whatever else is on their plate, but they can, to the maximum extent possible, divert public attention away from all the mud wrestling in Parliament to some other kind of conversation. Whether they'll be successful at it or not is a whole different kind of question.
And I think one of the things that the ANC risks, though, in this period is using the harsh language. So the sort of press release they sent out, I think it was Saturday or Sunday, saying that Parliament has a responsibility to protect the integrity of the institution, and also mentioned that these opposition elements are hell-bent on embarrassing the president and deputy president. What that press release was interpreted as, even though it didn't say it directly, was that the ANC wants Parliament to try and intervene to protect the president and deputy president from being embarrassed. And there's
but so doesn't that just say a lot though?
But they didn't say that. That's one of the key things. They didn't say that. That's how we interpreted it. That's how a lot of people interpreted it. And but that if we slot that into the language that the ANC and particularly the SACP as well is using, sort of calling like the EFF or opposition parties rebel movements and comparing
counter revolutionary, as well as rebel movements, comparing
them to Boko Haram
and fascists
and things like that. I think it does. The ANC is risking losing its legitimacy and sort of losing face in some of these things because it's going over the top in its reaction.
Well, too many people, however, will simply say, oh, it's all politics, all politicians are dirty, all politicians call each other names, it's all the same, it's all those people down there in the mud. Now, in a short term, tactically, that may be what the ANC wants, that this whole thing is just termed a squabble between people. Like, in the long term, though, it's a bad strategic judgment, because to lead a country, you have to create a sense of both narrative and goals. And narrative means you explain clearly what it is you expect, and goals, you articulate clearly where it is you're supposed to be going. And if you reduce everything to the question of simply poking each other in the eye all the time and gouging each other's eyes out, then the whole nature of the political process is enormously cheapened and turned into something that's a counterfeit of what it should be.
That might be a lot more fun to watch, though.
Oh, no, it's infinitely more entertaining. That's the problem.
Going back to Ranjini's piece on Monday, Ranjini Munasamy wrote an analysis piece on how, you know, the ANC is protecting Jacob Zuma, and protecting Olympus from falling. Brooks, you've been around for a long time. You've
Hundreds
of years. You've seen changes on the continent.
He's seen Olympus fall.
Yeah, he's seen it. He was there. He was there with.
I was there with a sign that said, "Be careful of the precipice."
And we've seen this happen so many times before on the continent, especially where the liberation movement comes into power, and then when things don't start going according to plan, they do whatever they can to hang on to power. And in a lot of cases, in most cases, with disastrous circumstances and results. Are you seeing some of those same nuances play out here?
Well, the usual rule of thumb has always been that a liberation movement has one generation or 20 years before it begins to founder, flounder, and eventually collapse in a heap. And more or less, this has been repeated in various places, not necessarily, for example, though, in Zimbabwe, where the liberation movement effectively now in the person of just a small number of people has been around since independence without any real ability to be shoved off the front. The problem here is, in South Africa, that the original people of the liberation movement are effectively almost entirely out of the picture now. They're either very old and retired, or in fact they've passed away. The generation of politicians in charge of things now are people who either came in early in the new period or have come up through the ranks at a time when politics meant getting a hold of the power that was already in the hands of the party, working your way through the system. So if you look at the ranks of people in politics, putting the president aside for the moment, and maybe the deputy president as well, virtually all of the other figures are now of the generation that has come to be when the party was already in power. And what you now have is a group of people who lip-sync the phrases of liberation, but they're really engaged in the process of either self-aggrandizement or aggrandizement on behalf of a faction. I mean, the SACP, the Communist Party, is a real case in point. When was the last time you heard an SACP explanation of something?
Makes sense.
That, A, makes sense, and B, relate to the presumed founding principles of the party.
Yeah.
It's what it is effectively now is a lobby on behalf of whoever is in charge of the mothership. If you look across the cabinet now, it's filled with people who really have risen up through the processes of the party as it's already been in power. And what they're doing now is they're protecting turf, they're managing a process of skewing or directing or guiding resources in particular ways. The argument before this last election was that the party had reached the point where the Democratic left would hive off and form its own party and give the governing party a real run for its money, a real challenge. In the event, that did not happen. That doesn't mean that it's not going to by the time the next election comes around. Maybe the folks who wanted to lead that charge have learned a couple of lessons about the need to organize themselves more effectively and articulate the kinds of choices that have to be made to get voters to pay attention, or maybe not. In which case, then, the party that governs will split along the lines of factions as opposed to ideas and principles.
So you think the floundering one-generation-later liberation movement model isn't going to apply in this case?
I'm saying the jury's still out on it yet.
And I think it's also quite interesting to compare, when we look at other post-colonial societies on the continent or countries, many of those places are operating under different conditions in different times as well. And so I think South Africa it features some of the same cases, but also some sort of different influences. And it is quite a different period that we're operating in than many of those other examples that we draw from. And I think the South African democracy has done markedly better than a lot of the other sort of post-colonial African societies. But at the same time, we are in that period now to sort of see what the ANC does. But it could sort of go either way, as Brooks was sort of saying, that we could see things split up and the ANC come under threat and perhaps even knuckle down and improve their relationship with the electorate. and perhaps sort of improve their democratic attributes and their performance in governments.
Does it feel,
also it could go the other way.
Does it feel like it could be we're at a cross in the road here, or a fork
in the road?
That's
what everyone talks about.
You know,
we're always at a cross.
It's which way are they going to go? Are they going to, you know, pull up their socks and make good on the promises and you know the proper way to govern, or they're going to go the other way?
I think as a broad generalization we can say that, but like Brooks just said, we're always at a cross in the road.
There's another thing to add to it, that unlike most of the other states on the continent, this place is more economically developed and diversified. And what that means is there are infinitely larger numbers of places to gain access to resources. I mean, if you were in Nigeria and you were trying to be the top guy of the heap, there's only really one place where the resources come from, and that's the oil industry. It's 95% of the country's exports, for example, export earnings. This country is very different, and the sources of wealth, the sources of power, and the sources of influence are much more diverse and more widely distributed. What that means is that different elements, different factions, different groups, if they gain access, control, management, or direction for one of those sources of resources and wealth, it's not necessarily true they now have a monopoly. Even if you were to control an entire mining house, just for the sake of argument, you might control a measurable chunk of the country's export earnings, but you would only have modest control over a share of the GDP of the country. So that the sources for wealth and therefore the sources to feed power are much more diverse than they are in most of these other places. And that's had both a positive and a negative effect. Positive in the sense that it doesn't allow power to be concentrated quite so quickly and quite so effectively in one place. Negatively in the sense that it gives all kinds of people a place to go. I mean, you only have to look at the most recent story. Your president is traveling to the United States on an aircraft, which happens to be owned and chartered to the government by a man who is the leading shareholder of a major arms production company, and who also happens to be a major contributor to the party. So
no conflicts of interest there.
I didn't say that. You did, but I'm nodding my head vigorously in agreement. Let's put it that way.
Potential. I want to move on and just touch on a piece that, Andrew, you've been working on. That's quite an interesting and sort of, incorporates a groundbreaking ruling that happened in Belgium. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it is a very interesting piece. There was a prisoner called Frank van der Bleeken, who was granted the right to end his own life on the basis of mental suffering. So Belgium is one of the only three countries in the world which permits where euthanasia is legal. And although there have been some cases, obviously, since it was legalized in 2002, which are based on mental suffering, most cases are still, most cases are terminally ill patients who are in a lot of physical pain. So van der Bleeken's case has stirred up a lot of controversy because of the mental illness aspect, and also because he's a prisoner, and as a prisoner, belongs to a vulnerable population where, potentially human rights abuses could occur outside of the public eye. So I think behind the controversy, firstly, is that it is true that it is much more difficult to regulate euthanasia on the basis of mental illness, just because, psychological illnesses are much more complicated than physical illnesses.
And they don't quite get the sort of, respect, basically, to be put on a par alongside physical illness in terms of, that's part of a broader general problem that mental illness has.
Yeah, so, well, I think
they're also harder to relate to as well, I think.
Yeah, exactly. So I think there are two things. I think, part of the concern is very valid because, it's hard to say, okay, well, this is what the mental illness is and every possible treatment option has been explored and it's definitely incurable and this really is the only option. So people are always going to worry that perhaps there could have been something more done And especially for prisoners, because, you know, the treatment options that are afforded to them really depend on the prison authorities. So outside of prison, you know, maybe there are more options out there and we wouldn't know.
So this guy, Frank van Beeken, he was incarcerated for 30 years, right?
He was in a psychiatric prison as well, because he wasn't held criminally responsible for his actions, because he has a psychological condition which, you know, he's subjected to these violent sexual impulses, which, you know, he says are beyond his control and which also cause him this very intense psychological anguish, because he views himself as such a menace to society and he can't help it. But then, as you say, aside from the legitimate concern around making sure that patients who are granted euthanasia for mental suffering, making sure that, you know, basically that they meet all the criteria, you know, that they're not just making these requests because they're very depressed, and, you know, that could have been treated and maybe a month later they have, you know, they change their minds or, you know, whatever the case may be. But yeah, as you said, at the same time, a lot of people just don't see mental illness as serious or as a valid justification for euthanasia.
But as a prisoner, if you're especially a prisoner with a debilitating and incurable mental condition, presumably you no longer have full control over yourself in a legal sense. You are at the institution has legal authority over your circumstances in a way which is a little different than if you or I were to be seized by visions and feel the need to end it all.
Exactly. And I mean, he was afforded a number of treatment options, but actually requested to be moved to a psychiatric facility in the Netherlands. And that was refused. And presumably there were a whole lot of reasons that was refused.
Foreign country was one of them.
Right. But yeah, I mean, his options are definitely limited as a prisoner. And, you know, historically, and also the reason today that euthanasia is illegal in many countries is that these abuses can occur, and especially for, you know, prisoners, mentally and handicapped people, you know, thousands of whom were wiped out during Nazi Germany under the pretext of euthanasia. So I think it's valid that people are worried, but what shouldn't happen is that, you know, we start to look at mental illness as not, well, not, at least not considering, you know, the potential that in certain cases it really is an incurable condition and mental suffering is just as bad as physical suffering. The problem is, you know, how do we quantify it and make sure that
And who gets control over the final decision?
Well, so I mean, I'm speaking in reference to Belgium now, but what they have there is you need three psychiatrists to agree that all possible treatment options have been explored and are futile, and then the patient also has to undergo a period of psychiatric evaluation. And, you know, a certain amount of time needs to pass between the request and, you know, it being granted. And obviously that's to, you know, give time in case, you know, something changes. But obviously, you know, it's not going to be 100% foolproof. But on the other hand, at least in a case like van der Bleeken's, at least, you know, these processes are followed. And hopefully in cases where there are alternative, you know, treatment options, the patient is alerted to these. And the alternative, you know, perhaps in countries where euthanasia isn't legal, the patient's going to find a way to commit suicide. And, you know, perhaps more patients die in those cases because they aren't, it's not regulated in that way.
Is there an organ donor question in this in any way hidden in lurking in the background?
No.
we just took a vote. The answer is no.
Andrew, can you tell me what was the reaction in Belgium, just from the public, to this decision? And are people worried that it could sort of open up the floodgates to many more requests along such lines?
Yeah, I mean, the reaction was mixed, and it's always has been controversial there, the mental suffering, you know, euthanasia on mental suffering, because initially when the legislation was passed, it was for physically terminally ill patients. And yeah, basically people are saying, well, this could sort of be a loophole in legislature and bring back a kind of a death penalty, you know, where a whole lot of prisoners who are miserable anyway request euthanasia, and it's a convenient way to sort of get rid of them. Obviously, that I'm putting it like
or
very.
Or you make their lives
really,
so yeah, or you
I'm
make their lives so miserable.
Obviously.
Subtly encourage them to consider this as an option.
Yeah, exactly, and maybe you know it. Then you don't have to give them all these complicated treatments and look after them. It's
cheaper too.
It definitely is. It's a lot cheaper. So yeah, I mean, and that's a slippery slope argument, and it's applied to euthanasia in general. You know, like what might the consequences be? But again, I think it just comes back to, you know, being very, very careful that regulations are followed and also that they're reconsidered periodically to make sure that, that there are proper safeguards in place against something like that happening, where suddenly you see, you know, lots of prisoners being put to death.
I think it's interesting to see that Belgium did, I think they updated the law, the constitution, to allow for mental suffering to be a justification or a justifiable cause to apply for euthanasia. So in that respect, I think Belgium has the most progressive euthanasia law in the world, which obviously have been highlighted by these cases. And another case where there was a guy who underwent a sex change, and it was a botched sex change, and his life ended up being.
So he felt like a monster, didn't he?
Yeah, felt like a monster on the back of being, you know, routinely raped by his brothers growing up. So I think he was another case that was granted, euthanasia on the basis of mental suffering. And in cases like that, you got to go. Well, it's hard to argue with someone who's had that kind of life, and you know, he really wants to check out now.
I find it quite interesting that having those laws then allow people to follow those, sanctioned procedures, whereas you would imagine someone in such a circumstance, perhaps in this society or many societies around the world, would simply commit suicide.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that it encourages people to go through sort of a legitimized process.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, I think also probably for the families, it's a terrible thing, but at least they feel like, okay, well, you know, he's tried to get help, and the psychiatrists agree, and you know these processes have been followed.
And that's the case. If you've got those processes in place, maybe that person who does go and commit suicide anyway could have been rehabilitated or treated in that, you know, had they followed those processes. It's only last resort.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, maybe if it was legislated and made available, that you know, there could have been people who'd been saved along the way.
Because so it might cut down on the suicide numbers.
Exactly. What's interesting to note is that South Africa is kind of stuck in limbo when it comes to the euthanasia laws. And just doing a little bit of reading about this, it seems that our medical profession condones the use of what's called, I think, passive euthanasia, which is basically if someone gives an advance directive before going into a vegetative state, the family is kind of allowed to pull the plug, so to speak, which seems to be condoned by the medical fraternity.
That's a physical terminal illness.
Yeah, on a physical terminal illness. But euthanasia outright isn't condoned by the medical fraternity. But what's interesting to note is that our law doesn't allow for that sort of pulling of the plug. And those advanced directives wouldn't hold up in a court of law in South Africa, and then we're kind of stuck in this limbo where we don't have the legislation, which is at odds with the medical fraternity, and that obviously can cause a whole lot of problem because it could open up someone to criminal prosecution.
Yeah, well, there's a slight slice over from that, and that the advance directive also speaks to heroic measures. That, you know, there's a distinction between letting someone die with dignity, giving them palliative care and the appropriate medication so that they feel less and less pain, and the withholding of certain kinds of treatments that would lengthen life for at least a small period of time. And a lot of people write the advance directive that says no heroic measures, at least in countries overseas. That has been upheld for the most part. But the next step over is a much more problematic area for a lot of people.
Cool. Andrea, any final words on the...
I'd like to hear a little bit about the law. I think it was a bill brought up in Parliament around 2000 on these issues about euthanasia.
The South African one?
The South African one I'm talking about. To just get our position on that and some detail on the legal parameters that are in limbo.
Well, the bill was commissioned by Nelson Mandela, in fact, and... gosh, I can't actually remember now the name of the group who...
It was the Law Commission.
Yeah, yeah. And basically, I think, proposed that euthanasia, both passive and active, be made legal in South Africa. And yeah, it's basically sort of just disappeared in Parliament since then. Hasn't been discussed, hasn't been open to public discussion. And, you know, in July, the debate was kind of, you know, stirred up again here when Desmond Tutu spoke out in favor of euthanasia, referring to Madiba. And there were a couple of other cases as well, which brought it to the public attention. But, you know, yeah, at the parliamentary level, nothing really seems to have been done to discuss any potential.
So there's fighters getting in the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I think the laws had been drafted in 2000 and it's basically been sitting there sort of in, you know, legal purgatory for, you know, just floating around and needs a champion in parliament, basically someone to push it. You know, we need a Maria Ambriosini, type person to get behind it and push it, because it's probably just going to keep coming up and start and causing more and more challenges, both for families and maybe in a, you know, it's going to be a case where there is going to be a criminal case filed against someone who ends up pulling the plug and then, you know, has to defend themselves according to an outdated set of laws.
I think the issue here is regulation would be very difficult. You know, you'd want every single case to go through, you know, a proper court procedure and process. And maybe, you know, one of the issues is we just don't really have the resources. You know, you don't want to be implementing laws like that if you can't implement proper regulations. That's really the main worry. So that it's very important that the two go together.
Okay, we've got a couple of minutes left. I'd like to talk about these two new towns being planned in Joburg, Brooks. You've done some work on this. The Steyn City, which I can think of a three-letter word to precede it that I think would make for a better description of the place. And the other one in Modderfontein being built by Chinese friends.
Yeah, well, both of these are an unusual take on the idea of city planning. Usually when you think of city planning, it's sorting out the transportation, the communication, the residential areas, the densification of a city zone so that as it grows, it's still both a useful and a pleasant or an increasingly pleasant environment. You add parks, you do this, you do that, you make transportation easier rather than harder. But what these do basically is to take large tracts of land, the one out near Dainfern in the case of Steyn City, and Modderfontein, which was the old AECI property on the eastern side of the city, somewhere between Oar Tambo, Tembisa, and some other part of Ekurhuleni, and say, okay, let's leave the city behind, in effect, and let's create an entirely new complex, not just a development, but, I mean, this is, you know, these are big things. They're going to have 100,000 plus people living there. And the theory is that you build a self-contained unit as much as possible that has
mixed-use commercial as well as residential.
Light industry, even educational facilities.
Health services.
The whole thing. But the problematic part is that it effectively means the people who live there and work there have abandoned the larger city. They've said that is a place of death and destruction and unpleasantness and messiness and chaos.
And basically, to hell with the rest of you guys. We're just going to go and create our own little self-sustaining village town here. And,
like Aranya.
Yeah.
Not very inclusive.
Yeah, well, I mean, like a very large Aranya, but without...
Is Helen Ziller behind us?
I mean, you know, on the one hand, if you were to go live into a nice, idyllic place where everything works and the people who have to clean up silently show up and they clean up and then they go away, but it has a slightly totalitarian texture to it, doesn't it?
And a bit of a Truman Show vibe.
I was sort of thinking of Elysium, the satellite surrounding the wasted Earth. And, you know, you could see the rest of us sort of living among the wreckage that the people who can afford Steyn City or Modderfontein Newtown have abandoned us for. The more problematic aspect beyond that is that one of them, at least, Steyn City, is actually going to have a physical perimeter around it. I mean, you may not need an ID card to enter, but you will be scanned somehow, some way.
Body cavity searched. And presumably these are being aimed at the wealthy.
Well, they're certainly not going to be aimed at the people who can't afford to live there. And in the current circumstances of South Africa, at least, it does occur to me that what's going to happen in both of these cases is that those people who want to work there and who can get a job there but can't afford to live there are going to, in the current argot, are going to create informal settlements on the outskirts. And you will have recreated the have-have-not dichotomy in microcosm as opposed to the country as a whole, and that cannot be good for the larger political, economic, and social processes of the country.
It just seems that if you're taking that investment and invested in into different areas of Joburg, or even if it was one single area, but within the city limits, and all that investment in infrastructure went into a place like that, that we'd be getting a much better social result out of that, as opposed to just sort of hiding away from the current problems that the city has.
If you look at the language that is in the, what amounts to the promotional literature that's come out for both of these, the key theme in them, and it's not so subtle, it says, you may not even have to leave. And, you know, that's a fairly strong whack across the head that says, forget about everybody else. Yeah. You're okay here. And I saw a video production of the Modderfontein one, and it had this enormous green expanse with recreational lakes and all kinds of other things. And my first thought was, where in the world is the electrical supply, the water infrastructure, the IT connectivity? Who's going to pay for all this?
But surely government must be linked up with these projects?
I don't think the government is thoroughly engaged in this yet.
Especially Modderfontein, because I know the government was you know, sort of celebrating when they heard about this investment from China.
When they heard about it, I think is the key phrase here. after they got the news of it. The Modderfontein one, especially, was one tract of land. And the company that bought it, Zendai, which is based in Shanghai, but listed on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange, bought the whole thing for, what was the price, a billion somethings, euros, dollars, rand, pounds, something. And it's a huge expanse, 1,600 hectares, which is not quite a small country, but moving in the general direction of one. And the government will have to be involved in all the infrastructure and all the land use discussions. But they're lucky in the sense that they don't have to go through the rezoning and the planning and getting all the people who live there now saying, wait a minute, that's my house. The Steyn City, I think they bought it chunk by chunk by chunk, so that when they ended up with the whole thing, they ended up with nobody else left to object to anything. But the psychological dimension of this just frightens me a little bit. Like everybody else, I want to live in a safe, comfortable, pleasant environment where I can go to a coffee shop and drink, you know, skinny cappuccinos all day long. But I also want to be able to go to museums. I also want to be able to go to a street where all kinds of people wander through and the frisson of excitement is real rather than contrived. Think of these as a very large version of Melrose Arch.
Agreed.
Where you've created, in Melrose Arch, it's very lovely to be there for a while, but you've created sort of an imaginary version.
Artificial.
It's like Disney World. It's like a city designed as Disney World.
Where all the people are the same. It's very homogenous.
Absolutely.
Sounds really depressing.
I find the interesting thing with something like Melrose Arch, where I used to live down in Marboneng downtown, where they have, it is sort of like a bubble, and you have this sort of controlled environment that has security guards on every single corner.
That's oppressive, really.
No, but at the same time, no one's stopping you from leaving, so you can just walk across into the next block or drive out of your car and go somewhere else if you like. So on the one hand, there is this sort of very much controlled environment where you do live, but nothing's also stopping you from leaving. But I think in this example
there's no wall around it. And
of these new cities, the new sort of thing is that's how they market it, that you never need to leave.
That's exactly the language. Now, on the other hand, Australia built a new capital that way too. I mean, built Canberra out in the middle of the outback.
But there was a specific reason behind that.
Of course. I mean, and that's my point.
And it wasn't safety or anything.
Brazil built a new capital for economic development. The United States built Washington as a political compromise between the North and the South to get the country feeling like it was drawn together. I mean, lots of countries build new capitals, build new cities.
But this is a private private city being built.
Precisely. These are
with an intention to keep a lot of people out.
You don't belong in our town because our town's only for people who can afford it.
Have they broken ground in these developments?
Stain City is the bulldozers are marching forward. Modderfontein, some of the road work, I think, has either been sketched out or even surveyed, but I don't think the machinery has started yet, but it will shortly. The other question, and I'll just leave it hanging because I don't have an answer, is there's an infinite number of construction contracts and other things that must end up being linked into this, and the supply chain stretches off to the horizon too. And the moment you do this on a mega scale, in an environment where certain moral compromises take place in the political process, you open up the environment for those kinds of transactions in this process as well.
You mean corrupt transactions?
I wasn't going to use that word either.
the potential, when there's that many number of zeros involved in any transaction, I guess the propensity is always there. But a very interesting dynamic to this is the question of population density in Joburg. Now, these kind of town developments don't help the density.
They go the
other way. And Joburg already has one of the lowest densities for a city of this size in the world. And I know, Andrew, you did some work on this when you were doing one of the facts of the day, just saying Joburg ranks really low on the list of major cities.
Yeah, I don't remember the exact numbers, but of the most densely populated cities, which most of them were in the Philippines, Joburg was something like, it was like a fraction. It was like 1/10 of the population density.
So you're saying we want a densely populated city like the Philippines? Is that what you're saying?
Not at all, but we do want a city where, you know, public transport and other facilities like that work.
It's
difficult
for
the infrastructure, right?
And obviously,
it's not too spread out, so that the governments can provide them sort of
exactly. Yeah, it makes it very difficult.
If it's too spread out. It's too much of a distance to cover.
You may not want to be Midtown Manhattan entirely, but Midtown Manhattan works because it is, or Manhattan generally works well because it is sufficiently dense that all the cultural amenities and fun things that people like, there are enough people who want them that support it. Transportation works because there are lots of people who, you're crazy to have a car in Manhattan.
And it changes the social dynamic completely because you've got that foot traffic. You've got that many more people out in the streets, walking the streets, which then also affects, you know, the ability for people to commit crimes, for example, or the incentive for people to go out and hit the streets and walk. We just don't have that in Joburg. We don't have that walk the streets mentality. And one of the reasons is because the population is so spread out and the density is so low.
There's an enormous perverse incentive in this country mentally to have your own detached or, at worst, semi-detached house. One, maximum two stories, a bit of garden around it, a bit of wall around the garden. And whether you're black or white, this is a national desire. There is really no compensating desire for, I want to live in an apartment, a flat, that is a lovely place, it's 5-6 stories up, I have lots of neighbors paying attention to this and that and the other thing, and we don't have to worry about the ground around it. And as a result, when you build one of these cities out on the fringe somewhere, you've lowered the density even further. Now, they're going to build apartment blocks in these places, but they're going to have an awful lot of open space as well. And because they're going to have all that open space, the density is not going to get higher. It's going to go the other way as well.
I see we've been given the wrap up sign by our producers. Tomorrow is Heritage Day in South Africa. Maybe quick round table. Brooks, what are you doing for Heritage? Are you whipping out the Star Spangled Banner? You're going to be watching Rocky. What are you up to tomorrow?
I'm going to sleep late, have a modest lunch, and then we have to go out for dinner where we will celebrate Heritage Day with people whose heritage I have no idea what they think of.
Greg, any Australian heritage being planned for tomorrow festivities?
I don't know. I'd love to have a VB, a barbecue, and watch the Australian footy, but instead we're working. So that's what I'll be doing.
Put another shrimp on the barbie, are we?
Andrea?
I actually haven't considered it up until now, but maybe a picnic in the sun somewhere. I think that'll be good enough.
Sounds nice. Yeah. Okay, that was the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. You can catch us at 1 o'clock on Tuesdays, or you can catch the podcast, which is available on cliffcentral.com, as well as the Daily Maverick website. Till this time next week, thank you for joining us.
The Daily Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com.